Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, September 18, 2013, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group Teleform Conference Call. On today's call, we'll be discussing the most recent Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals gun case. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that, as always, all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we're happy to welcome back to our Teleform Conference Call series Professor Nelson Lund of the George Mason University of Law School. He is a widely recognized expert in the Second Amendment, and we're very pleased to have him here today to give us his views on this important decision. We'll hear opening remarks of some 8 to 12 minutes, after which Professor Lund will take questions from the audience, so please be prepared with your questions. And with that, Professor Lund, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much. It's always an honor to be on these calls with the Federalist Society. A few days ago, the Illinois Supreme Court held that the state's near-total ban on carrying firearms in public violated the Second Amendment. The Seventh Circuit had already reached the same conclusion, and the Illinois court largely relied on the arguments in Judge Posner's opinion in that case. These are victories for gun rights, obviously, and they're also victories for the U.S. Constitution, which was correctly interpreted by both courts. I'm going to talk a little about Judge Posner's opinion, which is characteristically interesting and well-written. Before doing that, however, I need to provide a little background. 5 years ago, as you all know, the Supreme Court struck down Washington, D.C.'s handgun ban in the Heller decision. This was the first time in history that the court had found any law in violation of the Second Amendment. 2 years later, the court incorporated the Second Amendment through 14th Amendment substantive due process. Now, Heller has a good side and a bad side. On the good side, the Supreme Court recognized the two most important features of the Second Amendment's original meaning. First, the right to keep and bear arms is an individual, private right, not a right of the states to organize militias. Second, the purpose of the right is to enable individuals to exercise their inherent right of self-defense, including the right to defend themselves against criminal violence. The bad side of Heller has to do with what it says about the scope of the right to keep and bear arms. Everybody agrees that this cannot be an absolute right, protecting every person and every weapon from governmental regulation. On the other side, it presumably must extend farther than invalidating the total ban on handguns that was at issue in Heller itself. Unfortunately, Heller's treatment of the scope of the right and of the legal analysis that should be used to determine the scope of the right is an incoherent mess. The lower courts have been faced with the unenviable task of figuring out how to apply Heller to harder cases than handgun bans. Surprisingly, perhaps, the federal circuit courts have largely coalesced around an analytical framework that can be roughly summarized as follows. First, some regulations, primarily those that are long-standing, are presumed not to infringe the right protected by the Second Amendment. Second, regulations that severely restrict the core right of self-defense are subject to what's called strict scrutiny. Third, regulations that do not severely restrict the core right are subject to intermediate scrutiny. This kind of tiers of scrutiny approach is used in other areas of constitutional law, so it's not surprising that the lower courts would try to adapt it in this area, but it was conspicuously not adopted by the Supreme Court in Heller. Many of the judicial opinions applying this framework are written in a mechanical fashion that does not give much evidence of serious thought. What's worse, one frequently encounters a palpable hostility to Second Amendment rights. This hostility often comes out in the form of a so-called intermediate scrutiny that looks a lot like the kind of rational basis review that Heller told us may never be used in Second Amendment cases. This undue deference to the government has led courts to uphold statutes that I think are clearly unconstitutional, and sometimes on the basis of arguments that can hardly pass the straight-face test. Judge Posner is not guilty of these sins, and that's somewhat striking because we know from his extrajudicial writings that he is personally quite hostile to Second Amendment rights in general and to Heller in particular. Had he chosen to impose his personal views on the law, there was an easy and obvious way to do it. Several other courts had already issued opinions in which they pointed out, quite correctly, that the holding in Heller and in McDonald, the follow-up substantive due process case, held only that the Constitution protects a right of law-abiding citizens to keep a handgun in the home for self-protection. Using various formulations, these courts essentially said that they would not extend Heller beyond its technically narrow holding. To his credit, Judge Posner recognized that this is not how inferior federal courts are expected to treat Supreme Court opinions. The Supreme Court took the text of the Second Amendment seriously, and that text protects a right to bear arms as well as to keep arms. To say that the text of the Constitution should be read to mean only that you have a right to bear arms from one room of your apartment to another would obviously be a ridiculous kind of sophistry. Apart from the constitutional text itself, Heller contains many passages indicating that the purpose of the Second Amendment is to enable individuals to exercise their fundamental right of self-defense, including self-defense against criminals. The need for tools critical to self-defense is obviously not confined to the home, and violent criminals are probably a greater threat to most people when they're outside the home than when they're within it. Now, Posner refused to apply the tiers of scrutiny approach that I described a moment ago. Instead, he contended that courts should use a sliding scale in which the strength of the government's interest is weighed against the burden that the statute places on the individual's exercise of the constitutional right. At some theoretical level, I think the difference between tiers of scrutiny analysis and Posner's interest balancing analysis is a distinction without much of a difference. What's more important, though, is that Posner did not casually defer to the government's interests and arguments in the way that many other courts have done. In Posner's hands, this turned out to be a very easy case. He rightly concluded that there is essentially no evidence at all that could justify Illinois' total ban on carrying weapons in public, so the statute had to be invalidated. In that respect, the decision is like Heller. If the laws in either of these cases had been upheld, the Second Amendment would be essentially meaningless. But neither decision tells us very much about how far the government can go in restricting the right to arms or in placing burdensome obstacles in the way of exercising the right. Now, I want to conclude by noting one somewhat surprising development. Posner's opinion pointed out that Illinois was free to adopt a less restrictive law in place of the one that his court invalidated, and he indicated that he expected the state to adopt a very restrictive new statute. So did I. In fact, however, Illinois adopted a so-called shall-issue statute that requires the government to issue concealed carry licenses to anyone who meets certain objective criteria that most law-abiding adults can satisfy. I think the new statute is more restrictive than it should be, but it's much better than the so-called may-issue statutes that give the government virtually unfettered discretion to deny anyone the right to carry a weapon in public. I believe those statutes are unconstitutional, but they've been upheld by several federal courts. So it's an encouraging sign that Illinois did not adopt a may-issue statute. And I think that augurs well for the future of gun rights, both in the legislatures and in the courts. That's my introduction to this case, and I'm happy to talk about some questions that the audience may have.
Well, thank you, Professor Lund. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for Professor Nelson Lund, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Professor Nelson Lund, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines will be open, so I encourage you to ring in, star button, and then pound button. Let's go to our first caller.
John Rowland, Constitution.org, the day after Constitution Day. Are there any reasonably clear indications of the way the courts are going in terms of what kinds of restrictions they may uphold and may not, and what are the opportunities we may have to try to guide them in reaching those holdings?
I don't think there's any kind of really clear direction in which you could say the courts in general are going. What we observe is that a lot of courts just seem to be looking for ways to uphold whatever statute is being challenged in the case they're deciding. Then we see a few judges who take the Second Amendment seriously and provide the kind of serious analysis that Judge Posner, to his credit, offered in this case. Those are relatively, I'd say, a minority. And as a result, the overwhelming majority of challenges to gun laws have failed. Now, that's partly because of this hostility that we detect in the lower court judges often, but it's also partly because of Heller itself, which in a series of broad dicta kind of preemptively approved a wide range of gun control restrictions without any meaningful justification in terms of the original meaning of the Constitution or much of anything else. So there are a lot of cases coming up before the courts that the judges regard as easy cases for one way or another, and they uphold them. Now, what can we do? It depends on who you mean by we. Some of the litigators that have been working in this area on behalf of gun rights have done a great job. Some have not, and that includes some of the pro se litigants. It also includes, there's this problem that after Heller and even before Heller, criminal defense attorneys had an ethical obligation to raise Second Amendment cases, Second Amendment claims in a lot of cases where it was perfectly clear that the courts were going to rule against them. And so we've got a lot of kind of cases in which not much of a challenge could have been made, and or if it could, wasn't made. I think, in a way, the most important thing that could be done, in a certain way, the most important kind of thing that could be done now to enhance the future of gun rights is what happened in Illinois. Judge Posner appears to have expected a very restrictive gun law to be passed. So did I. Illinois seems to have this kind of culture of anti-gun culture, but in fact that didn't happen. And it didn't happen because of some unexpected, I think, resistance in the state legislature and lobbying by the NRA and so on in the state legislature led to a better outcome than one might have expected. So to the extent that the legislatures can show the courts that the courts aren't going to be regarded as nutcases if they rule in favor of gun rights, I think that will be helpful in beginning to dispel this hostility that we see in the judiciary towards Second Amendment rights.
A number of folks have dialed in late. We're speaking with George Mason Law School University Professor Nelson Lund, and we're in the question and answer phase of the call. If you have a question for Professor Lund, our lines are open. Push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone, And while we're waiting to see if there are other questions from the audience, Professor, you've alluded a couple times to resistance at the courts. Is there a distinction? I'm not sure if anybody studied it, but at least even anecdotally, is the resistance greater in state versus federal courts? Is it greater at the trial versus appellate level? Can you say more about that? Is it trending one way? I mean, are courts waking up to the idea that let me just stop the question there and see if you have a response.
Yeah, I'm not in the best position to answer that question because unlike the people who litigate these cases, I don't feel obliged to read every one of these opinions. So I'm not in the best position to talk about trends. I've mainly read the circuit court opinions in the federal courts, I wouldn't say that there's a trend. I just say that there seem to be two kind of judges, those who take the Second Amendment seriously and want to perform the kind of serious and rigorous analysis that they do in other areas of constitutional law, like the First Amendment, and those that don't. That's the way it looks to me from reading primarily federal circuit court opinions.
Well,
very good.
If I'm still on and we have no other questions,
we can hear you, General.
Follow up with a suggestion that perhaps those active in the field might try to begin to advance areas of regulation that would be consistent with the Second Amendment, namely regulation of militia, to require people to become organized, trained, and otherwise prepared to defend the communities from all kinds of threats, including but not limited to the use of firearms, and not as a condition for owning or possessing firearms, but as a general requirement that everyone be trained, which could be sold as an opportunity to screen people for their suitability, their fitness for the exercise of the right, and perhaps in extreme cases of competency proceedings which would remove the right from those that are dangerous to themselves or others.
Well, I don't have any particular objection to that sort of thing. I think it's just not a realistic prospect given the culture of our nation. We're not Switzerland. We're not Israel. And the idea that the government is going to bring back the traditional idea of a broadly based militia, I think is not a reasonable prospect in the United States. What I think is more realistic is that people who support gun rights can proselytize among their friends and acquaintances and introduce them to the shooting sports. I think we've probably all encountered people who suffer from a condition that a gun writer named Jeff Cooper called hoplophobia, which is an irrational fear of weapons. A lot of people seem to regard them as kind of magical devices that kind of just have evil within them and kind of afraid to touch them and things like that. And when people are introduced to the shooting sports, I think they become, less likely to have this kind of irrational fear of firearms. And I think over the long run, that would be helpful.
Once again, we're speaking with Professor Nelson Lund. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, good morning. This is Tobias Schleter with Ogletree Deacons in Chicago, Illinois. I'm curious about your thoughts as to whether there's a precedent or a predicate for some healthy limitation on gun ownership rights, where, I think even some of the staunchest advocates of gun rights may recognize that there are limitations. And if you look at Judge Posner's opinion, he seems to recognize that, you know, at least the predicate of it was, look, the Second Amendment certainly can't be read to limit gun ownership just to the home. It has to be able to extend beyond that. From a company-side lawyer perspective, we run into this tension, particularly under the Illinois law, where there's no limitation. You know, there's some limitation, but not concrete limitation that allows employers to regulate gun possession, you know, either in the parking lot or in the business in particular. And it creates sort of this tension, particularly with the rise of workplace violence, proximate temperature to employee outbursts or relationships, you know, and having a gun nearby, their societal sort of concerns. And then the ultimate legal proposition, which is a company allows guns in the workplace consistent with the law and may suffer a lawsuit because someone is harmed through use of a gun, or the inverse of that, a company doesn't allow weapons on the work site and someone sues because they couldn't protect themselves. So I'm just curious, you know, as a constitutional scholar and sort of from the development of the law, whether there is some healthy limitation, appropriate limitation that doesn't undermine the Second Amendment. And I guess I'm thinking it mostly through the lens of company protections and rights and wanting to protect their employee populations.
Well, let me just – there are two questions here. One is a very general question to which there's a very easy answer. Any sane person recognizes that some restrictions on gun rights are appropriate and constitutional, any sane person. The second question is, well, what particular regulations? And let me just kind of address the problem faced by companies with employees very briefly. As far as I know, the U.S. Constitution, including the Second Amendment, does not prohibit the owners of private property from telling people they can't bring guns on their private property. So I don't think the Second Amendment really has anything at all to say about whether a company can forbid its employees to bring guns to work or other people who come on the premises from bringing guns on the premises. Now, as a matter of state law, I think that's up to the states from the point of view of the federal constitution. And I know some states have said that there are limits on employers' ability to restrict the gun rights of their employees and visitors to their property. Whether that's constitutional under their state constitutions is something I don't know about it, but it's up to the state constitution. Assuming that the state constitutions don't have anything to say about it, you know, then it's a policy question, and I might have my views on the appropriate policy if I spend some time thinking about it, but it would be a policy question, not a constitutional question. Certainly it does seem to me that states would be well advised to adopt some kind of law that prevents employers from being caught in a potential catch-22 under state tort law, but that's up to them.
Well, this is Dean Reuter again. Let me make a final call for questions. Our lines are completely open. If you have a question for our expert, Professor Nelson Lund, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Star button and then pound button on your telephone. Looks like we have another question, so let's go to our next caller.
Good morning. This is Ed Murphy in Chicago. And I wanted to ask the professor if he was familiar with the Illinois Supreme Court decision that was decided last week, which found that the Second Amendment applied outside the home. Because I was a bit surprised at the strength and the unanimity of the Illinois Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, you must have come in late on the call. Yes, I've read that opinion. Basically, the Illinois Supreme Court just said that Judge Posner's opinion in Moore versus Madigan was right, and they followed it. I don't think that's, you know, I don't know the Illinois Supreme Court. I don't know the Illinois legal system at all. It doesn't seem very surprising to me, because if they had not decided as they did, there would have been a conflict between what the Illinois Supreme Court is saying and what the Seventh Circuit is saying. And I think it's pretty clear that ultimately that conflict would have been resolved in favor of the Seventh Circuit. So why create a lot of difficulties by creating such a conflict? Apart from that, Judge Posner's opinion is so persuasive that I would like to give the justices of the Illinois Supreme Court credit for having recognized the persuasiveness of Judge Posner's opinion.
Do you think, Professor, that the Illinois Supreme Court, having gone the way they did, will be of some encouragement to either the lower trial court levels of the various federal courts or the Supreme Courts of other states carrying the right, the Second Amendment right, outside the home, because the United States Supreme Court hasn't gone that far yet?
Well, as I said in my opening remarks, I think the Seventh Circuit case, and this Illinois Supreme Court case, they're both really easy cases. You know, if the courts wouldn't come out that way in these cases, then the Second Amendment just doesn't mean much of anything. But what that is going to, how that's going to influence other courts, is hard to say, because there are no other states that have the kind of extreme law that was struck down in Illinois in these cases. So I just don't think that these cases tell us very much about how other courts or these courts will decide more difficult cases or cases that are closer questions. That, after all, is what we saw after Heller. After Heller, which was another easy case, because the law at issue was so extreme, then the lower courts dealing with closer questions came out in different ways and largely in favor of upholding governmental regulations.
Do you have any thoughts on how the U.S. Supreme Court may go on the cases that inevitably, I think, will get there in determining whether the may issue states in terms of concealed carry, which in some instances seem to be quite capricious in who gets a license and who doesn't, whether that violates the Second Amendment.
Well, one of the easiest ways to make a fool of yourself is to predict what the U.S. Supreme Court's going to do. So I'm a little hesitant to do that. I guess if I had to offer my best guess, it would be that unless the personnel on the U.S. Supreme Court change, in other words, as long as the same nine justices are there who are there now, I would guess that they will put some limitations on the ability of the states to enforce these may issue regimes that are so extremely capricious. How many restrictions they would put on the states of discretion to issue carry licenses, and what kind of restrictions they would place in them, I don't know. But I'd be surprised if they just gave them a pass. The current nine justices, or more precisely the current five justices, who voted with the majority in Heller and McDonald. I don't think they would just give the – I wouldn't expect them to just give these states a complete pass on enforcing these regimes. But who knows?
Thank you.
Let's take another question. And a reminder to our audience, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hi, this is Dave Tryon in Cleveland at Porter Wright. So, Professor, I see that most of the attention in the law and the cases and legal scholarship is focused on the Second Amendment in connection with gun rights. However, most states have provisions in their respective constitutions involving gun rights and akin to the Second Amendment. Have you examined if there's many cases going on throughout the country that are now asserting the state right provision as opposed to the Second Amendment?
This is not an area that I've studied. So I can't answer the question in the general terms in which it's been asked. My impression from what reading I have done is that it varies a lot from state to state. Doesn't seem to have as much to do with the wording of the state constitutional provisions as it has to do with the kind of culture of that particular state and particular judiciaries. I mean, there have been cases which I kind of noticed when news about them pops up, where state courts have enforced much more robust Second Amendment rights than anything we've seen in the federal courts. But there are other states where they've done just the opposite. And my impression is it doesn't have much to do with what is in the state constitution and more to do with the judicial culture of the state and the political culture of the particular state.
Nothing like the rule of law.
Right.
Thank you.
All right. We've got another question, so let's go to our next caller.
Hi, my name is Mike Easter. I'm out in California, and there's some proposals going about to try to limit or prevent or bar the use of lead bullets for hunting or target shooting. I'm wondering to what extent the Second Amendment protects the ability to have access to, ammunition.
Well, I think it certainly does protect access to ammunition. And there have been proposals to, we won't ban guns, we'll just ban ammunition, that kind of thing. I think those are subject to the same kind of analysis and the same kind of limitations that that direct regulations on guns are held to or should be held to. Generally speaking, if your right and ability to defend yourself is not compromised by using other metals than lead in the bullets in your ammunition, then I just don't see any serious Second Amendment problem. Where you might imagine some serious issues being raised is if the government tried to restrict its citizens to possessing only ammunition that was extremely expensive. So if substitutes for lead bullets were, prohibitively expensive, that would be, a serious problem under the Second Amendment, in my opinion. My impression, though, from what I know about the technology of ammunition, is that probably would not be the case, but I don't know that for sure.
And as a corollary question, there's been a number of efforts to try to restrict or bar certain types of rifles, say, for example, with detachable clips. To the extent that those laws are passed, can they be applied retrospectively, say, for example, to ban rifles with those features, like the AR-15 type rifles?
Well, those kinds of things raise those kinds of restrictions on so-called assault rifles. They raise a somewhat different legal issue, I think, because these statutes have been quite common. Some new ones were adopted after the massacre in Connecticut. They've generally been upheld by the courts. In fact, I don't know of any that's been any court that's struck one of those things down. I think they're plainly unconstitutional for the following reason. Every one of those statutes that I'm familiar with bans certain weapons on the basis of features that are primarily cosmetic, and they leave people with the right to have other weapons without those cosmetic features that are functionally pretty much indistinguishable. And that is so irrational from the point of view of the government's legitimate interests in reducing violent crime that I think the statutes are unconstitutional for that reason, even if, as may be the case, if you can't get an AR-15, you can get a different kind of rifle that works pretty much the same and gives you the same ability to defend yourself. But, you know, in the Second Amendment area, just as in the First Amendment area, I don't believe the Constitution should be interpreted to allow the government to make these capricious and arbitrary and useless infringements on people's rights just because they want to make a kind of political grandstanding move. You can't do that in the First Amendment. I don't think you should be able to do it in the Second Amendment area either.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate it.
Again, if you have a question, push star and then pound on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
John Rollenbach. There's been some other proposed approaches that should reach the courts if they're enacted. One approach is to impose taxes on firearms and ammunition. Another is to impose a requirement for liability insurance. And we still have the problem at the federal level, a lingering finding by the Secretary of the Treasury that certain semi-automatic shotguns are, quote, destructive devices, unquote, and which therefore makes them either bans them or requires them to be registered. What do you think are the prospects of these approaches if they are litigated?
Well, again, I don't want to predict what any particular court is going to do about anything. It's just, you know, it's just too uncertain. What I would say is that in general, I think there's some of the most difficult and important questions about the Second Amendment rights that are going to come up in the future, in the near to medium future, involve governments saying, look, okay, we understand under Heller we can't have these draconian bans. So what we're going to do is we're going to make it as difficult as possible for people to exercise their Second Amendment rights. We're going to have all kinds of restrictions. We're going to have taxes. We're going to have this and that. And we're going to have bans on so-called assault weapons, and we're going to have high-capacity magazine bans, and we're going to have extremely onerous bureaucratic processes that you have to go through in order to have the be given the right to possess or carry a weapon. And in the First Amendment free speech area, you know, we have a long tradition of the courts wrestling with those kinds of things, and they're often not easy to tell where the line should be between an overly burdensome restriction on a right and one that's not overly burdensome. And I think in the future we're going to have a lot of such cases. We saw this in both D.C., District of Columbia, and in Chicago after the Heller and McDonald decisions, respectively, the legislatures have went back and pass these new statutes with all these kinds of restrictions on them. And I think the real test of the court's seriousness about the Second Amendment is how serious they're going to be about scrutinizing these kinds of burdens on Second Amendment rights. So far, the news is not good. They have not been very rigorous in scrutinizing these things. There have been some exceptions. One of the best opinions that's been written so far is in the Seventh Circuit, again. This was an opinion by Judge Diane Sykes, which refused to uphold Chicago's ban on shooting ranges. And she provided what I think is a model of how lower court judges should interpret the Supreme Court's decision in Heller in a way that kind of makes sense of it and takes the Second Amendment seriously. But I have to say that Judge Sykes' opinion is it kind of stands out in part because partly because it's so good, so well written, so well thought out, but also partly just because taking the Second Amendment seriously has been so rare. And so I think the news right now is not very encouraging about that.
Well, let me make a final call for questions here. Our lines are completely open. If you have a question for Professor Nelson Ludd before we conclude our call, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Well, Professor, it sounds like you've exhausted the questions from the audience. I certainly appreciate you being with us today. This has been a helpful and informative session. So I thank you on my own behalf and on behalf of the Federalist Society. To our audience, a reminder to monitor your emails and check back on our website for a schedule of upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.